Chapter 8 Buccaneers and Pirates. Armed now with the reasonable suspicion that our government had no clue what it was doing, we dove back into the data. It was a treasure trove. Looking at large contracts for important things, we focused in on companies that sounded funny, that we didn't recognize, or that promised stuff we now understood was hard or impossible to find. Then we looked to see when the business entities were created, if they had done previous work with the government, if their proprietors had previous legal troubles or political connections. Our subjective honing process was hit or miss, but always entertaining. My colleague, Lydia DePillis, a brilliant economics reporter, noticed a $14.7 million contract the VA awarded to an Ohio company named Aunt Flo, which sold tampons and other menstrual products that are dispensed in women's restrooms. It sounded absurd, but DePillis called the company's CEO and learned the company had done something clever and maybe useful. As its orders slowed due to the pandemic lockdowns, the company converted its own manufacturing facilities in China to produce surgical masks and began selling them to the government and its clients. The company also tried to delve into making N95s. Much more complicated. The CEO told us she had to cancel her deal with the VA because the Chinese government seized her shipments that were bound for the United States. In the data, we found another peculiar deal awarded to Zach Fuentes, Trump's former deputy chief of staff at the White House. Just 11 days after he formed an LLC, he was awarded a $3 million contract for masks by the Indian Health Service, an agency within HHS that provides medical care to Native American tribes, which were hit hard by the virus. Fuentes delivered a tranche of the Chinese version of the N95, called KN95s, destined for the Navajo Nation, but the agency would determine that most of what he delivered couldn't be worn by medical staff because it didn't meet FDA standards. The agency would later request a refund, which Fuentes would refuse. In the data, we'd find former telemarketers whose records included allegations of fraud, but who were now entrusted with delivering millions of masks and coronavirus test tubes. Dozens of the companies we plucked out had been created just days before landing multi-million-dollar contracts. It appeared that anyone who paid a nominal fee to create a limited liability company could land a multi-million-dollar contract in the very same week. One of the largest orders for masks at the time went to Panthera Worldwide LLC, which, despite its grandiose name, was a tiny company in Virginia. A quick court record search showed the company was in bankruptcy, and its owners were being sued by former business partners for fraud. And the IRS had placed tax liens on both owners in 2018 for failure to pay taxes. Yet, FEMA awarded the company a no-bid $55.5 million deal for 10 million N95s. For surgical masks, FEMA also hired a boutique liquor company in California, which was in the middle of fighting a high-profile fraud suit, which, to be fair, doesn't bar someone from becoming a major federal contractor. A nuanced picture was emerging. The United States was desperate. China was holding back. Manufacturers and entrepreneurs were filling the space, and money was being sent to whoever dared to play the game. The stockpile was empty, and every level of government was struggling to restock. Our national well-being now rested with mercenaries. The money was going out so fast that what math we did was irrelevant the next day. But by late April, the government had handed out more than $1 billion and counting to hundreds of first-time contractors. A cottage industry was cropping up around federal government purchase orders, fueling an emerging black market and frustrating the search for the same supplies by states, cities, and hospitals. We pitched a story, and from our apartments and homes, we set out to call each company to gather responses and relevant context and break what we in the business call a quick-hit investigation. I was most intrigued by the VA, The department had denied news reports of widespread shortages of protective gear for medical staff, but the data seemed to agree with doctors and nurses. The department's contracts people were panic buying on an unprecedented scale. In late April, the department granted a $14.5 million contract for N95 respirators to Bay Hill Defense in Pittsburgh. We found the company was listed to the home address of Andrew Taglianetti, a former University of Pittsburgh football player and an aspiring arms dealer. Bay Hill Defense had never won a federal contract, according to federal data. But Taglianetti's website claimed it sold ammunition, assault rifles, grenade launchers, and more to the United States and other friendly nations. Seeing what the VA was doing, I wanted to look a little closer at the contractor who had landed its largest order for masks, about $34.5 million for 6 million of them. At nearly $6 a mask, that was a whopping 350% markup for a mask that usually costs about $1. It was federal government experts' first ever government contract. Of all the no-bid contracts at the time, this company ranked number 10 in total value. Its owner, Robert Stewart Jr., didn't stand out in court records and the usual places we look. But there were other reasons to wonder. First, the company's name, Federal Government Experts, aside from being a little on the nose, suggested the company was devoted to federal contracts, yet on its website it advertised a robust private sector client base. The website was also filled with stock art and ambiguous descriptions of the firm's expertise. For instance, with continued growth and increasing competition in the federal sector, we have developed a dynamic business management consulting process. Our process has yielded unmatched results for our clients. I could not discern what that meant. This company was expert at everything, from temporary staffing to IT consulting to a blockchain AI solution to government procurement, whatever the hell that meant. Yet there was no evidence that anyone besides Stewart worked there, and there was no record of the federal government ever hiring the firm. The company was based in Virginia, but had little footprint there besides a tiny office in Falls Church. Stewart did know his way around contracts, though, because he'd worked for years as a procurement officer at the Pentagon. His posts on social media gave the look of a one-man operation being run from an old desktop computer. The workday was nearing its end, and I was still doing the due diligence, planning to call Stewart in the morning, when a colleague sent me a link to a news article. My heart sank as I read the headline from the Wall Street Journal. U.S. pays high prices for masks from unproven vendors in coronavirus fight. The article mentioned federal government experts and Stewart, Panthera, Aunt Flo, and more. It was the exact story we were working. I flipped my laptop to sleep and cursed the news gods. I coped in the usual way. I poured a tall scotch. Then another. The morning after realizing the journal had already executed the story we had in mind, I woke to a headache and the self-loathing any reporter who's been beaten knows all too well. It was the last Friday in April. I knew I'd need to dust myself off and come back with something stronger the next week, as this whole pandemic thing showed no signs of abating. I cooked eggs and bacon to the din of bad news spilling out from the morning CNN announcer and thought about what that article did and did not say. The truth was, it didn't tell us all that much. It was too early to tell who was legitimate and who wasn't. In the end, it was what data reporters refer to as fancy arithmetic. It added up contracts, gave some totals, pointed out the outliers, and filled the numbers in with a couple of interviews and cross-references to public records, such as the articles of incorporation that every company must file with their state's Secretary of State. I don't begrudge this whatsoever. It was, after all, the exact story I had pitched. There was also one bit near the end of the article that just didn't sit right with me. The journal had quoted Stewart, the CEO of Federal Government Experts LLC, as saying, "I'm getting ready to step on a Boeing 737 to bring the masks to the VA." This felt oddly specific, and at this point, airports were still ghost towns. The 33-year-old entrepreneur told the newspaper he was at the port of Los Angeles, about to go through customs. "I'm looking at a few million masks right now." But how? How did this guy, who had never won a federal contract, who had no apparent experience buying, importing, freighting, or reselling medical equipment, even in the bustling days before the world shut down, how did this guy, with a tiny office in suburban Washington, D.C., manage to do what no one else seemed able to do? I decided to click a little deeper into the company's website and notice something I had overlooked. My spidey senses were tingling again. A detailed outline of his firm's process included a hierarchy of consulting purposes, a pyramid that one could climb toward greatness. As someone who's watched countless consultant firms do their best to destroy American newspapers while using inane buzzwords, I'm skeptical of consultants. Setting that bias aside, though, there was something off here. It described 8-tiered purposes of any consultant, starting with the 2 building blocks of providing information to a client and solving a client's problems. A successful consultant could ascend all the way up to tiers 7 and 8, facilitating client learning. And the final pinnacle, the apex, the nirvana of consultant achievement, permanently improving organizational effectiveness. This was deep nonsense. But more than that, it struck a different tone from the vagaries and puffery that littered the rest of the website. This section read almost academic. Here's where I turn to one of investigative journalism's most powerful tools, Google, and plugged in a particularly grating and likely unique passage in quotes. "The lower numbered purposes are better understood and practiced and are also more requested by clients. Many consultants, however, aspire to a higher stage on the pyramid than most of their engagements achieve." And bing. The search engine zipped me straight to a 1982 article in the Harvard Business Review titled, "Consulting is More Than Giving Advice." Large passages were lifted verbatim. It was funny, but big deal, I thought. It wasn't even worth a tweet, let alone a story. But it did tell me something about the guy. It told me he was willing to deceive. That's when I decided to call him, even though we'd been beat, just to see what he would say. A couple of hours later, Stewart returned my call, sounding agitated. He said he only had a few minutes to talk as he sealed up his $34.5 million deal with the VA. He'd be boarding a non-commercial flight the next morning for Hines, Illinois, outside of Chicago, to supervise delivery of 6 million N95 respirators. His deadline was 2 days away, Sunday, at midnight. When I asked how he managed to get such a big contract, even though he had very little relevant experience, he told me the contract staff at the VA liked my technical approach. He did not specify what that technical approach was. That didn't mean too much to me just yet. Because he is a black owner of a small business and a veteran of the U.S. Air Force, the government is required to give companies like his preference in certain circumstances. "We don't like China," Stewart offered, unprovoked. "But when our ass gets jammed up, who do we go back to? They know they have us by the balls because we're a consumer nation. We don't produce anything anymore." The irony of us being so reliant on China, our sources of PPE being yet more reliant on labor in, of all places, Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak, was worth reflecting upon. But my reporter brain was still stuck on the non-commercial plane. My research didn't indicate he had the kind of scratch that can cover a private jet, so I asked who was footing the bill. "A veterans organization," he said. Though he wouldn't specify. He claimed he'd signed a non-disclosure agreement with this organization, which seemed odd. If this mystery organization had, in fact, paid for the delivery of masks to the VA, that would be fabulous public relations fodder. Famously, Robert Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots football team, had lent out his plane to deliver some supplies, to some applause. Stewart also offered that he was exhausted beyond belief because he'd been working the phones day and night while quarantining in his Virginia home with a newborn baby. Quarantining? I asked. Didn't you tell the Wall Street Journal that you were in L.A. looking at a shipment of masks? The Journal misunderstood him, he claimed. He meant he was figuratively looking at a shipment of masks. This was not how the article read, but while we were on it, Stewart needed to vent about the Journal article, which he said was unfair and made him look like a crook. I told him I thought the article was fair, and that he was barely mentioned at the end of it. That's the thing that was kind of fucked up, Stewart said. At the end was, well, he was a contract. That infuriates me to no degree. I don't do stuff like that. Like what? I asked. My mom wrote the editor of the Wall Street Journal, Stewart said, dodging the question. My mom and dad raised me to be a man of integrity. I had not questioned his integrity, but he seemed to need to defend it, so I obliged and asked him if there was reason to question it. No, he responded. The real story, he said, was the intermediaries, the middlemen, with whom he'd found himself dealing late into the night. He described, and I'd find it to be true, that the overnight craze to buy and sell masks had produced multiple inefficient layers of private profit and government waste without any of the transactions seeing the light of day. I got a guy. This deal was much more complicated than anyone knew, Stewart said. If I had these things in my basement 90 days ago, shit, yeah, I'd be rich, Stewart told me. He would, indeed. He could have delivered the cash to the VA and collected the agreed-upon 350% markup. Fast, easy, simple. But Stewart didn't have any product on hand, so he had to take the not unusual but seldom advertised route of essentially becoming the master contractor who builds the deal, working with various subcontractors who take their negotiated shares, the ultimate buyer none the wiser. It's sort of like when a homeowner commissions a repair job with a general contractor, and that contractor hires an electrician, a tile guy, and framers, and in turn, maybe each of those tradesmen contracts out some of the work. So, armed with his government purchase order, or PO, for $34.5 million worth of masks, a figure that was broadcast to the world, Stewart sought to find a guy who knew a guy who had masks, or knew of someone who might know of someone who did. He called it a broker chain. In these chains, secret intermediaries collected handsome fees for setting up deals and greasing the skids from the comfort of home. Everyone involved signs a non-disclosure agreement to avoid any potential scrutiny. I needed to learn the mechanics of these broker chains. As Stewart explained it, after all this wheeling and dealing and doling out everyone's cut, he didn't expect to pocket as much as he had hoped. Maybe creeping up on $1 million, he said. It's a bunch of buccaneers and pirates, he said. But so were the men who made America. You're going to have a lot of millionaires that come out of this. They're just scoundrels. You have this black market, he continued. When the cat's away, the mice will play. It's like robbing Peter to pay Paul. We were on the record, and the guy was on a roll, so I spoke as little as I could while he talked. He was not one of these pirates, he explained, but he stood to gain from the lack of government oversight just as they did. Because of the fact that there is a lack of oversight, there is an opportunity that wouldn't have existed to prove I can do these things, he said. One thing I've learned about liars over the years is that many will overshare on details peripheral to the truth they hope to conceal. The blunter and more truthful they are about certain things they might believe, the less likely someone is to think they're lying about the subject at hand. It makes sense on a human level. Liars only succeed if they are trusted, and bonding begets trust. For a second, I admit, it was almost working. I genuinely liked the guy. I laughed and told him he reminded me of a wonderful quote from Lord Littlefinger Baelish, the evil schemer in HBO's Game of Thrones, who once said, "Chaos is a ladder." I wish I had remembered the complete quote at the time, because it would have been prophetic. Many who try to climb it fail and never get to try again. The fall breaks them. My head was spinning. I told Stuart I agreed that this underworld of broker chains and investors was the bigger story, and I'd love his help in telling it. "No problem," he said. As a veteran, he found the whole affair disgusting. "You and I could go and start a cartel, and it would be less conspicuous than this. It's a multi-layer, hidden society of people. It's sketchy shit, man. You gotta see it for yourself." That was my opening. I said that was a great idea and asked, "Well, how about I get on the private plane with you?" "Sure," he said. He had nothing to hide. I got off the phone and immediately called my editor, Marilyn Thompson. After the lockdowns came in March and April, ProPublica's top brass made the ethical decision to make no effort to purchase N95 masks for reporters to go into the field, so as not to further deplete supplies for healthcare workers whose need was greater. Reporters were ordered not to go out into the field whatsoever. Our charge was to cover the largest and only story on Earth, most likely the biggest in our lifetimes, and it had to have investigative impact. But we couldn't go anywhere. I did not disagree with this policy, but I needed to ask that we break it. And being that I was one of the newest and youngest reporters on a fledgling team in D.C., and knowing I had zero political influence, I was almost certain I'd be told no, and I would have to resort to being a pain in the ass, an area where various bosses have told me I excel. I dreaded this. I was in just about the worst position a reporter can be. I hadn't yet published anything big. I had nothing big coming down the pike. And now I was about to make trouble for overtaxed editors who were very aware of both of those facts. "We have to get on that plane," I told Marilyn, who agreed but said we needed approval from New York. As expected, I got on a conference call with senior editors and was met with skepticism. I understood. They were worried about my safety, of me sharing air with random people as we soared over the earth in a tin can. I reiterated my case. "It's a private plane. There's something off about this guy. Red flags, government money, people are dying." They weren't buying it. We ended the call with a tentative no, but we agreed to take the matter to the top editor. A few hours later, my editor and I got on a call with Steven Engelberg. Aside from being a thoughtful and nice guy, Engelberg was once a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, whose enduring appetite for a big story is as ravenous as any journalist I've known. One gets the sense that the guy really, really misses being a reporter. He was all over this story when it seemed to me that it was just some bug in China, and having co-written a book years before about germs and biological weapons, he knew his stuff. It was the day's end, at the end of a trying week in our new reality. The other editors, who were trepidatious, had gotten tied down with childcare and other duties and couldn't make the call to offer counterpoints to my pitch. Engelberg gave it his usual, insightful, out-loud breakdown of the variables and potential consequences, and came to the conclusion that, if I was aware of and willing to take the risks, and as long as I understood that in no way was management asking me to take such a risk, he saw no reason to keep me grounded. Chaos is a ladder. Engelberg offered sincere and detailed caveats and asked for my reassurances that I would mask up and quarantine for 14 days when I returned. I was also told that the company life insurance policy might not pay out if I went down in a private plane. We were in agreement, and I was given permission to be the first ProPublica reporter to go out into a contagious world. Stuart almost came to his senses. We had switched to texting, and after several attempts to get him to divulge who was paying for the plane, something we needed to know to ensure we weren't wading into any ethics issues. Like, say, what if the Trump campaign was funding it? Stuart finally said his company was paying the bill. He sent a photo of the charter receipt, which showed a $22,080 charge to his company's account. We agreed that we'd reimburse him for my seat at the prevailing rate for a similar commercial flight, which is standard journalistic practice for reporters who travel on Air Force One, for instance. It came out to about $200. I packed a bag filled with surgical masks, notepads, a camera, and a change of clothes, and booked a one-night stay at the Hilton near the VA warehouse outside Chicago, where he said he and a few employees would stay. Everything looked good, until he sent an ominous text message at 11:11 p.m. "Sir, trip has been canceled. Do not want to speak on it at this time. Beyond my control." "Oh, wow," I replied. "Canceled for everyone or just me? Will you reschedule?" I was disappointed. But something about the way I responded, I suspect, made Stewart want to prove he was the real deal. Just seconds later, he pinged, "We will still make the trip," followed by, "Keep the course." We agreed to meet at 7:45 the next morning at the executive wing of Dulles International Airport, just outside D.C.